Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in History. I'm Stephen Colebrook. Today I'll be speaking with Brett Crutch, author of Dying to be Normal, Gay Martyrs and the Transformation of American Sexual Politics, published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Crutch examines how secular LGBTQ activists use public mourning and memorialization as strategies to influence political debates over LGBTQ rights and to promote assimilation. Brett, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So I'd like to begin by asking you about your own intellectual background and what brought you to this particular topic.
Sure. I've had a bit of an unorthodox queer academic background. I studied religion and gender studies at Emory University as an undergrad, and then I went straight to graduate school at Harvard in their divinity school. This was 2002, and I wanted to look at queer issues and religion. And at that time, there was no one at Harvard who really could even imagine queerness and religion coming together as an academic topic. So I left after 1 year. I like to tell everyone I'm a Harvard dropout. And I went to NYU in New York and finished a master's degree there and then stayed working at NYU for a few years. And then I started writing about LGBT issues in the United States and publishing some freelance essays in the Washington Post and Newsday and The Advocate. And in doing that, I started thinking again about what an academic career would look like and how I could bring some of my thoughts on contemporary LGBT issues in the United States to religious studies scholarship. And so what I most wanted was a mentor, which was what I didn't have when I was at Harvard. I wanted someone who could really help guide all of that. And so I was fortunate to study under Rebecca Alpert at Temple University, who was one of the people who led the way in thinking about queer issues in religion and in particular queer issues in American Judaism. And so I finished my PhD in 2015, and I'm now at Haverford College, where I teach on religion and U.S. politics and religion and sexuality.
Great, fantastic. So your book sort of feeds into debates about queer assimilation. Could you just outline exactly what that means for our listeners and also sort of how it fits into the broader history of gay activism in the last 20 or so years?
Certainly. So the book looks at the two-decade period of 1995 to 2015, and I selected that particularly for the question that you're asking. In 1995, at the end of that year, is when in the United States, medications became available that really dramatically changed the AIDS epidemic. And for many people with access to those medicines, it changed HIV/AIDS from a largely deadly situation to a more manageable one. The death toll declined in 1996 for the first time. And so in 2015, 2 decades later, that's when the U.S. Supreme Court made same-sex marriage a legal possibility throughout the country. So I was interested in how, in that 20-year period, did we go from an image of a queer community that was largely associated with death through unbridled sexual frivolity, to a very different image 20 years later of LGBT people as committed to lifelong coupled monogamy. How is it that some LGBT people, particularly gays and lesbians, were able to become normal in many Americans' eyes?
So how did religion, and in particular Protestantism, feed into that assimilation?
Right. So this is one of the interventions that I want to be making into discussions about assimilation broadly, which is many people have noted that this process is raced, which it is. It has a lot to do with whiteness. It has a lot to do with gender conformity. It has a lot to do with class. But it also has to do with being in the United States, religion, and being religious in ways that align with the ideals of white mainline Protestant Christianity. And so I focus on these martyr figures, people who become political emblems for the LGBT movement, like Matthew Shepard and Tyler Clemente and others, and how activists use religion to present those martyrs to the American public as acceptable gay figures. And part of them being acceptable is by using Christianity in particular ways that resonates broadly with the American culture.
Okay, so your first chapter details the reaction to the assassination of Harvey Milk, one of the most important figures in LGBT history. Could you just briefly outline who Harvey Milk was and also the circumstances of his death?
Sure. So although the book looks at 1995 to 2015, I felt that I needed to include Harvey Milk because although his death occurred in 1978, he became a more prominent martyr figure for the LGBT community many years later. When he died in 1978, there wasn't a national reaction to his death. It took time for many more people to learn about who Harvey Milk was. So he becomes much more famous and popular in death, and he changes in death. As a martyr, he's a different person than he was as a man. So Harvey Milk was a gay Jew who grew up in New York, and he moved to San Francisco in 1972 at the age of 42. Prior to that, he had never been involved in gay activism. But he owned a small business, and he became annoyed by a particular tax he would have to pay. And out of that annoyance, he ran for a position on San Francisco's Board of Supervisors, which is a local city council position. He lost, and he ends up running for election multiple times. And on the fourth time of running for something, he wins a seat on the Board of Supervisors. And throughout those years of running for things, he developed a reputation as an advocate for the gay community in San Francisco and for California as well. And 11 months into his term, another person on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Dan White, assassinated both Milk and San Francisco's mayor. And then since then, activists starting in San Francisco, but then it over time grew nationally and then internationally, turned him into a martyr figure for the LGBT movement.
Great. So could you just outline for us the process of him becoming a national martyr as opposed to just a local martyr in San Francisco, and also how religion played into that, particularly his Jewishness, and how the memory of Harvey Milk is very different from the man?
Right. So to get at that, what I do in chapter one is I also narrate some of American AIDS history, because that's what really is taking place then after his death in 78 and then in 1995, the period that I focus on. And what I hone in on particular in that chapter is the AIDS quilt, which became the largest AIDS memorial in the world. And it was started by a friend of Harvey Milk, Cleve Jones. And Jones has written and has said in interviews when describing why he created the AIDS quilt that he wanted a memorial that would not be threatening to non-gay people, right? Part of the concern with the early years of the AIDS epidemic was that many people with AIDS and their friends believed that most straight people did not care at all, that gay and bisexual men were getting sick and dying by the thousands. And so Jones said he needed something that was palatable to heterosexual audiences that would also get a reaction. So he comes up with this idea of the quilt, where each quilt panel is about the size of a human coffin to represent all of the lives lost. And the point that I'm trying to make by describing that history in this chapter is that then in many ways, Harvey Milk, as a martyr, is like the AIDS quilt. He's someone who in death becomes more palatable to mainstream heterosexual audiences and Christian audiences who aren't as familiar with Jews and Jewishness. So the efforts to make him into a martyr actually start soon after his death. There's a book that comes out about him, a documentary film, an opera. And this all sort of builds and grows. In 2003, this is how I open the first chapter. In 2003, there's the first museum in the United States for LGBT history. And it's in San Francisco. And at the opening exhibit of the very first museum, the centerpiece of this museum opening is Harvey Milk's suit that he was wearing when he was shot to death. And the museum hangs his suit with outstretched arms so that it looks just like a cross. The exhibit is titled something about the life and afterlife of a modern gay martyr. And so I open with that to just show, you know, right away how Christianized he's become in as a martyr. And so much of the ways in which he's memorialized in plays, in books, in the operas, in the major motion picture Milk is an erasure of much of his Jewishness, not always all of it, and it's different in each representation, but he becomes significantly less Jewish. You know, he had grown up in this Long Island Lithuanian Jewish family where they had founded their own synagogue. They had started a Jewish social club on Long Island because the Jews in their area had been excluded from the more WASPy social clubs. He joined a Jewish fraternity in college. He could still carry on bits of Yiddish as an adult. He attended a Passover Seder with the same friend every year in San Francisco. And he himself spoke about his Jewishness as what contributed to the type of gay activist he was. He talked about the Holocaust with some regularity in his speeches and how that shaped him and how he felt it should inform the ways that gays respond to oppression in the United States. But most all of that becomes erased in his memorialization. And then the other thing that I focus on in terms of making him palatable is he becomes far less sexual. So following the AIDS epidemic, where gay men in particular were blamed for bringing this plague to the United States through sexual promiscuity, I just don't think that a major emblem for the LGBT movement could be someone who openly thwarted the Protestant sexual expectations of monogamous coupling. But that's what Harvey Milk did and was. And it wasn't just for the sake of it. He wrote and spoke on developing a sexual ethic that was about loving more than one person at the same time. He believed that communities could be strengthened if people were not paired off into possessive couplings, and that if everyone could be honest about loving more than one person at the same time or having sexual relations with more than one person at the same time, then that could strengthen communities. And so, but that sort of sexual ethic, that outlook was, following the AIDS epidemic, not palatable, really. And so he becomes far less sexual as a martyr to make him appeal to broader audiences.
Hmm. Okay, so your second and third chapters, in many respects, look at the other side of this coin. So you have the erasure of Milk's Jewishness versus the kind of focus on a particular type of person in the 1990s and the early 21st century as the typical gay martyr, as it were. Could you briefly describe what the characteristics of that was, and also the circumstances around the tragic death of Matthew Shepard?
Sure. So Matthew Shepard's murder in 1998 is, he becomes the first LGBT person in America whose death instantly mattered to the nation. So although there were certainly thousands of people in San Francisco who cared that Milk died in 78, we get a totally different, much bigger national reaction when college student Matthew Shepard is murdered in 1998. So President Clinton, the president of the time, issued a public statement from the White House when Shepard was killed. Within the first week after his death, there were more than 60 vigils and memorial marches across the country, many with thousands of people in attendance. There was a vigil for him on the steps of the United States Capitol building that was attended by congresspeople and senators and celebrities, and that was televised. CNN had requested that his funeral be broadcast live so all Americans could participate in mourning Shepard. His family denied that request, though, but they allowed reporters into the church. So this is a very different reaction, and part of the questions for this chapter for me were, you know, why did Americans, why did straight Americans who had been rather silent and apathetic about the vast number of gay, bi, and trans AIDS deaths and other anti-LGBT murders, why did they care so much about Shepard? And there are many reasons for that, and they intersect. They in part have to do with race, right? He's white and blonde. He's male. He's a gender-conforming male. He's middle class. He's in college, which is respectable. And he also, although he was 21 when he was killed, a legal adult, he looked much younger. So he was only about 5'2" tall and weighed around 105 pounds and still wore orthodontic braces. So although he was technically an adult, he looked much, much younger, and activists were able to emphasize that he was an adolescent. And this is at a time in the United States where there's now this a few decades history of political rhetoric about protecting children. And so now Matthew Shepard becomes an emblem of a gay adolescent, which was different from the typical image of LGBT people, which was usually that of adults separate from families. But here was Shepard, who looked like this kid who was part of a loving Christian American family. And the Christianness then is what I really highlight, because activists highlighted it. And then the media recycled what activists highlighted. So, you know, the public was told, for example, that Shepard joined only two clubs at his college, the University of Wyoming. He joined the LGBT student club and the club for Episcopal students, right? So he's a committed practicing Protestant. The American public was told that he had been an acolyte in his Episcopal church. So he hadn't served as an acolyte for years, but structuring him as an acolyte, or reminding people that he had been an acolyte, presented the public with an image of like this good Christian youth, rather than, and this connects to the earlier chapter, rather than to an image of a sexualized adult gay man. So as the good Christian youth, his sexuality gets stripped away here, and he becomes safer and more palatable to the American public. The other piece related to religion with Matthew Shepard that I think is important is that it's through Matthew Shepard that the American public becomes introduced to someone who will become an infamous figure in the United States, and that's the Reverend Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church. So Fred Phelps had been protesting at the funerals of gay men who had died from AIDS complications for many years, but he really had not gotten much media attention. But it's through Shepherd that Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church become household names. So as I had mentioned, CNN had wanted to broadcast Shepherd's funeral live, but the Shepherd family said they didn't want that type of scrutiny on that day. And so the press largely turned their attention to what took place outside the funeral, which was when Phelps and about 15 to 20 people from his Westboro Baptist Church protested outside Shepherd's funeral with signs that said things like "Matt in hell," and Phelps would wave a Bible and scream things like "God hates fags." Outside the funeral that day, about 1,000 people who didn't know Shepherd also showed up just to be of support. And when they saw the Westboro Baptist Church protest, they linked arms and formed a line in between the church of the funeral and the Westboro Baptist Church protesters and started singing very loudly the Christian hymn "Amazing Grace," with the hopes that the people inside the funeral would not hear any of the anti-gay screaming. And as reporters came out from the funeral and started talking about it, they reported that Matt Shepherd's cousin, an Episcopal priest, starts the funeral by saying things like, "Matt is loved by God, and Matt loves God, and that love is more powerful than any voice of hate." So we have these images and rhetoric of Shepherd as loved by God juxtaposed with this image of Phelps waving a Bible and screaming "God hates fags." And we have a literal dividing line, right? These Amazing Grace singers, 1,000 of them linking arms. And I think for many American people, that image of Phelps on the one end with the vitriol, and then this 5'2" young looking Matthew Shepherd on the other, and the Amazing Grace singers in between, really sent a message like, which side are you on, right? Are you on the side of the person who is waving a Bible and angrily screaming, or are you on the side of the docile, meek, practicing Protestant who happens to be gay? And for many Americans, I do think that was a really significant turning point for them in their thoughts about gay people in the United States.
Okay, fascinating. So my next question brings out to the more present day. I was wondering how the It Gets Better project feeds into current narratives about gay martyrdom.
Sure. It was actually It Gets Better that started this entire project for me. It Gets Better started in 2010 as a response to LGBT teenage suicides, and it became very popular quickly. Tens of thousands of people made It Gets Better videos, including celebrities and politicians like President Obama and lots of straight people, made these videos telling LGBT youth, "Don't worry how bad it is now. Life will get better." And for me, I thought there was something strange about everyone telling LGBT youth that life will get better simply because they will get older. That there's certainly no guarantee of that. And so I wanted to think through, why do so many people support that message? And one of the reasons, there are many, and again, they have to do with class and race and gender. And so I look at, who's been making It Gets Better videos. And in one way, in the book, I highlight sort of the lack of contributions from many different types of religious communities. But I also felt there was just something to that message, right? Like that your pain and your traumas have a purpose, and your life will be better because of what you've gone through. And in some ways I make the argument that that idea that your pain has a purpose and will lead to a better life is a sort of secular Christian message that certainly resonates for many Christians and even for non-Christians living in a predominantly Christian culture. It's certainly the ways that many Christians narrate the story of Jesus, of his degradation that leads to glory. It's certainly the story of many Christian martyrs in early Christianity, the Middle Ages, and more recently, that one's pain and suffering has a purpose for a greater good. And so that's part of the religious messages of It Gets Better. It's also, you know, in the It Gets Better narrative, the people who started, Dan Savage and his husband, Terry Miller, they say things like, you know, you have to tough this period out. And that also sort of resonates as a sort of turn the other cheek, have faith in the march of time. Everything's moving teleologically towards better days. And, you know, these are all faith-based promises, right? There's certainly no guarantee of that. And I think the present political situation in the United States speaks to the fact that there's certainly no guarantee that the future will be better than the past.
Okay, so your chapter also deals with the tragic death of Tyler Clementi. Could you outline the links between that and the It's Get Better project?
Absolutely. So Tyler Clementi committed suicide in 2010, and he becomes the next LGBT person in the United States to immediately garner national attention after Matthew Shepard. So in the 12 years that have gone by, Clementi is now the next person that really gets massive national attention as an LGBT death. And what I wanted to highlight is that although 12 years have gone by, the type of person who gets public mourning and who activists then turn into a political emblem and who straight Americans seem to care for and want to produce cultural change for, well, wouldn't you know, he looks very, very similar to Matthew Shepard, right? So Clementi, again, is white, male, gender conforming, in college, young, he's 18, right? So also technically an adult. But the American public was constantly told that he was a violin prodigy, and prodigy, you know, signifies youth. And he was also a practicing Protestant in different ways than Shepard. Shepard was a mainline Protestant, meaning non-evangelical, and Clementi was quite active in an evangelical Protestant church. So the discussions around religion play out differently with Clementi than they do with Shepard. But I wanted to highlight that. Look, you know, the image of who counts as normal, who counts as acceptable, who counts as worthy of public mourning really hasn't changed that much. And if those are representative of who matters in this country, those are very narrow parameters, right? You've got to fit a very narrow set of identities and boxes to be seen as worthy of the America public's attention.
Okay, so we know that there's a current epidemic of violence against transgender folk, particularly transgender folk of color. So how has the response of gay rights activists been to these deaths? And also, how does it differ from the forms of gay martyrdom that you outlined earlier in your book?
Right. So I wanted to make that the full focus of one of the book's chapters. And so that's the fourth chapter's focus, where basically I'm saying, okay, look, so all of this time where Matthew Shepard, Harvey Milk, Tyler Clementi have become household names and have been used for political purposes, throughout that whole time, there were other LGBTQ activists who were trying to make certain people into martyrs, who were trying to make the deaths of particular LGBT people into household names, but with much less success. And those people were overwhelmingly transgender and queer people of color. And so I wanted to look at some examples of that and some things that were going on throughout the same time period that were not focused on white, cisgender, middle-class gay men. And so in this chapter, I focus on three films that LGBT activists use as a way to try to get this message across and try to get into, you know, American homes, and thinking about film as a strategy for LGBT activism. And so the first I focus on is the film Boys Don't Cry, which is about the murder of transgender man Brandon Tina. He was murdered in 1993, but the movie Boys Don't Cry, which made him more well known, came out in 1999. And his death, his murder, is significant for a few reasons. One, because at the murder trial for his death, many trans activists showed up and spoke to the small media presence about his murder, and many credit that moment as something that ignited a national transgender political movement. And it's in that period that we start seeing more use of the word transgender as opposed to some older terms that were used. And then the 1999 film Boys Don't Cry, you know, received Academy Awards. It was very well received both by critics, heterosexual audiences, and queer audiences. And it made Brandon's story better known to the American public. But part of what I address in the book is that in the almost 20 years since the movie came out, transgender activists and people have really now protested this film because of having a cisgender actress play the transgender part. And so I focus on how transgender politics have changed just in this short period of time, and how a movie that initially was pretty well received has now been boycotted and protested in various places. I also highlight that the way that the film constructed Brandon in 1999, I believe, was based on the popularity of Matthew Shepard as a beloved, sympathetic figure, that Brandon, as presented in the movie, is quite similar to Shepard. I also then focus on the 2001 murder of F.C. Martinez, who was a Native American Navajo. His mother uses male pronouns, but F.C. was 16 when murdered, assigned male at birth, but started wearing makeup and carrying a purse to school around middle school. And FC's mother, when this started happening, said, you know, there's a word for that in Navajo for people who are partly male as well as partly female. We call it Natle. And FC apparently responded, oh, so cool, I'm a Natle. And so I highlight then in this section of the chapter how more than 140 Native American nations before they were colonized had language and terms to describe more than two genders. So the Navajo, for example, had four genders. Some had three, some had many, many more. But the film that I highlight in that section of the book called Two Spirits really presents how assimilation to the white Christian culture of the United States has been quite dangerous for gender variant Native Americans and Native Americans more broadly. And so the film uses Martinez's murder to address this historical erasure of gender variance and gender diversity within Native American nations. And so they show one particular painting in the film of Spanish conquistadors, the Spanish colonizers to the Americas continent, who would take gender variant Native Americans and throw them into pits publicly, where then dogs would attack them, you know, to send a very public message that this was never going to be acceptable. And so then, you know, one of the things I want the chapter to question is really how much safer are gender variant Native Americans in the present day than in centuries ago when colonizers first encountered them? And how have these sort of assimilationist politics, or how do these assimilationist politics contribute to more violence against gender-variant people and queer people of color broadly? The last main thing that I look at in that chapter is a group of women from Newark in New Jersey, a group of Black queer women, Black lesbians, who were attacked in a homophobic assault in New York City. They weren't murdered, but a heterosexual man on the sidewalk catcalled them. And then they, you know, tell them that all seven of them are lesbians. And then he becomes rather violent and starts threatening them. He eventually pulls one of the dreadlocks of one of the women with such intensity that he yanks it from her scalp. He starts choking another one. And while he's choking one of the women, one of the smallest women in the group pulls out a small penknife and lunges for him and ends up hitting both his backpack and his abdomen. He told first responders that he didn't even know he had been stabbed until he saw blood on the ground. But then what happens is all seven of those women, although they were attacked and there's security footage to show that, and really defending themselves, they all got arrested and were sent to Rikers Island Jail. The man who started the homophobic assault never was arrested. And three of the women accept plea bargains, and then four of the women go to trial, and all four of them were sent to prison for various time periods. And even before that happens, what I highlight in the chapter is the way that the New York City newspapers, including the New York Times, describe this group of Black queer women as a gang, as a violent gang, you know, and who the press really presented as guilty long before their criminal trial. And I use that to highlight other instances of violence against queer people of color, particularly trans women of color. So I highlight the case of Cece McDonald, who was attacked in a similar situation by a white woman and white man outside of a bar in Minneapolis, where a white woman smashed a bar across this transgender woman of color's face. And then a man with Nazi tattoos basically came after her to attack her. She pulls a pair of scissors out of her bag to protect herself, and they go into his abdomen, and he ends up dying. And the transgender woman of color is who ends up going to prison, not the white woman who started the whole thing. So I wanted this chapter to address, you know, all of these ways in which these promises of it gets better and the veneration of white cisgender men really means nothing to many segments of the queer community within the United States because of the ways that issues of race in particular shape our criminal justice system and who Americans see as worthy of value.
Mm. Okay, so a slightly more thematic question, taking your book as a whole. Given the assimilationist strategies of mainstream gay martyrdom, has there been any space during this period for a kind of more queer memorialization that rejects assimilationist strategies?
Yes, and I think in some ways that, you know, has always been there. And with each sort of move for more mainstream assimilation, there have been pockets of the LGBTQ community who have resisted this and have wanted a queerer outlook. And we can see that sort of through each period. I really focus on that more in the book's epilogue, which looks then 1 year past the 1995 to 2015 period for the book, and looked at the Pulse nightclub shooting in 2016 and responses to that. So the Pulse nightclub shooting was the largest mass murder of LGBT Americans in U.S. history. and it was primarily LGBT people of color who were killed at Pulse nightclub. I compare it with what had been the largest mass murder of LGBT people, which was an arson attack on a bar, the Upstairs Lounge in New Orleans in the 1970s, that really got very little attention. More than 30 gay people died. But Pulse became major national and international news. And what was unique about Pulse is that, you know, many of these earlier figures that I discuss in the book, it's really just LGBT activists who use them for political purposes. But with Pulse, lots of people use the Pulse murders for political purposes. President Obama used it to advocate for greater gun control legislation. And then primarily, then candidate for president Donald Trump used the Pulse murders to say that he had been correct all along about the need to ban Muslims from entering the United States. But what comes from that were several sort of queer alternatives to memorialization and queer rejections of being accepted by mainstream white heterosexual American culture. So one of the things that I highlight in the book is soon after the Pulse nightclub shooting, another gay club in Orlando hosted a memorial for those who died at Pulse, and it was hosted by a drag queen. More than 40 drag queens from around the country came to the memorialization. And it was a night of heavy drinking, heavy dancing, and was really meant to, you know, I think, say to the world, if this person who came into Pulse wants to eradicate what queer people do when they gather in clubs at night, then we're going to be even more outrageous than we were before. And you start seeing op-eds in places like the New York Times saying things like that. And a new activist group formed in the wake of the Pulse nightclub shooting called GAG, Gays Against Guns. It's meant for LGBTQ people. It was formed by people who had been active in the AIDS activist group ACT UP, which was certainly an anti-assimilationist group. And they've been getting quite a bit of attention for the types of protests that they do across the country. And so then I also, you know, use that epilogue to highlight the work of other people who more recently have gotten a little bit of attention, like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera and Audre Lorde, all people of color who really rejected assimilation and who felt that assimilation will always marginalize more people than it will include them. And that if we are going to turn people into political emblems, then perhaps we should be looking at people who were thinking about those who've been excluded throughout this whole time.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for being on the program today, Brett. That was a very interesting conversation. We just have time to ask you one more question, which is, what are you working on now?
Sure. So I'm currently finishing co-editing a book with Nora Rubel at the University of Rochester that is called, or is tentatively called, Queer Jews on TV, Transparent and the Changing Landscape of Jewish Popular Culture, that uses the television show Transparent to think about transgender representation, queer politics, and Jews in America in the first decades of the 21st century. And then I'm also starting work on a new longer project that looks at the rise of religious freedom bills and rhetoric in the United States as one of the primary ways of opposing LGBTQ political advances.
Well, that sounds fascinating, and I very much look forward to reading the results of that research. Thanks again for being on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me, Stephen.